We're continuing in Mark chapter 15 from verse 33. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God."
Well, thank you, Miriam, and happy Good Friday, everyone, if that's the thing. I don't know, I've been saying that to everyone, but it's great to have you with us here today. What is so good, though, about Good Friday? I mean, apart from the day off work, the festivities, the hot cross buns, which are a year-round favourite in our household, why do they call the day itself good? How can the death of Jesus on the cross, which those buns point to, how can that be a good thing, many will ask themselves? To many it seems tragic, the cross, the waste of an inspiring young leader. To many it just seems irrelevant now, happened so long ago, 2,000 years ago, how can that be any use to us today? To many the cross seems barbaric. When we think about crucifixion, such a horrible way to die. And for sure, on the surface, the gospel accounts like Mark's that we've just had read to us, they are painful in some ways to read. But dig a little deeper, and Mark shows us that Jesus' death is the most wonderful event in all of human history. And I hope we can just think about that this morning for a little bit. We're going to reflect on the two cries of Jesus in that final reading as he hangs on the cross. The first, a cry of suffering. The second, a cry of death. But through the pain and the sorrow, I hope we'll see how that first Good Friday, 2,000 years ago, really was good and is still good for us today. So you'll see on the handout, on the reverse of your sheets, our first point there, Jesus suffers facing God's judgment. God's judgment is what is signified by the darkness in verse 33 of Mark 15, if you glance back there. When the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. I don't know if you've ever seen an eclipse. I remember lots of hype about the so-called total eclipse in 1999 when I was on holiday with my family. Some of us had bought those cheap little eclipse glasses, a bit of sort of flimsy cardboard and sort of cling film sort of stuff that some guy had flogged to all the tourists. And we were out waiting for the moment when the sun was supposed to be blocked out very dramatically for a few minutes. But I don't know if anyone had this experience, was there, but it was a massive anticlimax. I can't really remember anything happening, and it turns out that it being cloudy was enough to obscure it all. But that is not what is going on in the account that Mark writes. He was writing about a supernatural event that day. There was a proper darkness, a darkness over the whole land for 3 hours. From the sixth hour, that is midday, 12 noon, to 3 p.m., normally the brightest time in the Middle Eastern sky. Can you imagine how eerie that would have been for it to suddenly just fall dark? The sun, with its heat, just disappears, and there is this cold, chilling darkness. It was a foretaste of Judgment Day. A few chapters earlier in Mark's Gospel, Jesus spoke of the final judgment as a day when the sun would be darkened as God rightly punished wrongdoing. Well, here was a preview of that final day, a preview of Judgment Day. And anyone who knew their Old Testament prophets now well would have recognized the sign. Amos, for instance, says this, "On that day," that is the day of the Lord, Judgment Day, "darkness I will make the sun go down at noon, Amos foresaw, and darken the earth in broad daylight. As Jesus hangs on the cross, the parallel is clear. The sun disappears at noon, and the earth is darkened from broad daylight. See, part of God's judgment was visibly being poured out in advance. But on who? Well, remarkably, on Jesus. Jesus facing God's wrath. The next verse, verse 34, I think shows us that. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus was experiencing being forsaken by his Father. He was bearing the full force of God's holy displeasure. And that is an incredible, shocking thing in Mark's gospel, because two things are repeatedly stressed in the verses just before this, in our two earlier readings. You may have noticed them. Jesus is innocent, and Jesus is God's king. You may have noticed those themes. Jesus is innocent. His enemies accuse him, but they fail to accuse him, to convict him of any wrongdoing. And Pilate, the Roman governor, gets exasperated even, says, why? What evil has he done? Jesus is innocent, but Jesus is also God's king. You see, his claim to be king was the only thing that they could charge him with in the end. And so the Roman soldiers give him this crown of thorns and kneel before him, mocking, Hail, King of the Jews. Even the inscription above his cross says, King of the Jews. And so on one hand, this is very shocking. God's innocent king is the one suffering here. And yet, on the other hand, it shouldn't be that shocking, because all of this had been planned out beforehand. Jesus himself had predicted three times his arrest, his suffering, his crucifixion. And also now here, as he hangs there and he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's also quoting Psalm 22, a song written by the Old Testament's greatest king, King David. Because Jesus is reminding us at this moment that suffering is actually a confirming hallmark of God's true king. Suffering is actually a hallmark of God's king. I'll read a few verses from Psalm 22, and just try and notice how David's suffering all those years before foreshadows even the smallest details of his descendant, King Jesus. All my bones are out of joint. My strength is dried up, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. You see, the cross was always the plan for God's true king. Here is no mistake or tragedy. The royal pattern had been laid out long ago. This is what makes Jesus actually truly kingly, like David. God's true king had to suffer like this. But if this was all God's plan, well, why is it suffering? What is the purpose of all the suffering? That brings us to the next sub-point. Jesus was facing God's judgment in place of others. Jesus explained this back in chapter 10, that verse that Chris opened our service with. He says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus' life is the ransom price given in place of others' freedom, spiritually speaking. And the stress on Jesus' innocence in chapter 15 reminds us of this statement. He's clearly not suffering for any sin of his own. He must be paying this ransom price in place of others. It's the story of an Italian policeman during World War II called Salvo D'Acquisto. By 1943, the Nazis had taken control of his hometown. And one September morning, Salvo saw a group of feared SS soldiers approaching. A Nazi officer came straight up to him, accusing his village of a nearby explosion that had killed a Nazi soldier. And this officer was furious. He gathered up all the villagers that he could find, 22 people, and he told Salvo, if you can't find the person responsible, they will all be shot. Well, no one came forward. And so the villagers were forced to dig their own mass grave. But seeing the judgment was about to fall, Salvo stepped forward and spoke up. Even though he was totally innocent, he took the blame, saying that he had caused the explosion and had acted completely alone. He stressed that the others should be let go. See, those villagers had had this terrible sentence hanging over them, but Salvo redirected it onto himself. He acted as a substitute, and he faced the firing squad alone that day. He took the punishment in their place to save them. And that is like what Jesus did as he hung in the darkness. He was redirecting the sentence that hangs over sinners like you and I onto himself. Even though he was totally innocent, he willingly faced God's judgment in place of others. And there are lots of other hints of this substitution throughout the chapter that we've heard read this morning. It's pictured with Barabbas, the guilty criminal, whose life sentence for murder is inexplicably redirected onto Jesus. I mean, imagine how Barabbas would have felt sitting there in the prison when he heard that he was going to be set free and that Jesus would go to the cross instead. And imagine him watching just a few hours later as Jesus hung there. And he was thinking, that should have been me, but Jesus has taken my place. And it's not just Barabbas. I mean, none of us have lived as we should. We have all failed God's perfect standards. Every person, the Bible says, is guilty before God. But Jesus, though innocent, takes the punishment for the guilty. He is a willing substitute. Jesus is the only person without a sentence of his own to pay for. And so only Jesus can take our place. And remarkably, wonderfully, he's willing to do it. Even as he's taunted on the cross, he cannot save himself. Well, the irony is, Jesus could have saved himself, but he refused to do so. He wouldn't save himself because he was so determined to save others. He stayed on the cross and faced God's judgment. He suffered. And if we're Christians here this morning, we have the privilege of saying, he did it for me. He did it for me. As the song goes, it was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished. The real tragedy is that so few people understand what was really going on at the cross. Even on that day as Jesus died, as he cried out, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's surrounded by misunderstanding. Bystanders seem to misunderstand him saying Eloi for Eli and think that he's calling the prophet Elijah to come and rescue him. You see, to most, this once popular figure had become some needy, pitiable figure on his way out. And that is what we can expect from the world around us today as well. Most people that we know, friends, colleagues, they don't see Jesus for who he really is. But that actually means that they are the ones, tragically, who are needy and pitiable. They are facing God's sentence of judgment, like we all rightly do, and yet they don't even know it. They are lost and ignorant. But Jesus always had compassion on people like that. Think back to Jesus feeding the 5,000, and we read, Jesus saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, lost. See, Jesus came for people like that, people who don't even know that they're in danger, like clueless sheep without a shepherd. He came to take the place of people like that. And that brings us to our next point, the second cry as Jesus dies, opening salvation. Jesus' second cry is striking because crucifixion was designed to exhaust its victims so that they could no longer pull themselves up on the cross to breathe, and they would just quietly slip into unconscious suffocation. But in verse 37, we see that Jesus is able to utter a loud cry as he breathes his last. It seems to be another reminder that he is no passive victim here, but rather Jesus is actively at work even as he dies. He is there on his own terms. He is achieving just what he promised to do, salvation. But it is this moment of his death where his judgment-bearing, ransoming work is completed, and he truly opens the way to salvation. Mark shows us this with a sudden scene change in verse 38. If his account were a movie, it's as though the camera pans away from outside Jerusalem, where the crucifixion site was, just for one verse, back to the city centre, to the temple. And the camera zooms inside to the enormous curtain that hung in the innermost holy place where God's presence symbolically dwelt. That is why people went to the temple. It was the way to approach God, to relate to him, to make sacrifices for forgiveness. But as Jesus dies as the perfect sacrifice, the innocent sacrifice, well, God does away with the old temple system. Have another look at verse 38 if you would. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. You see, any in the temple that afternoon would have heard an almighty shredding sound as God literally ripped up the holy place. It was a huge sign that the temple system is now redundant and that God had left the building. That phrase was announced at the end of Elvis concerts to try and get rid of the crowds who were hopeful waiting for an encore. Elvis has left the building. It meant that there's no point hanging around because you won't find Elvis there anymore. Well, similarly, this ripped curtain means that there is no longer any point hanging around the temple because we won't find God there anymore. The temple served a makeshift, temporary, limited purpose, but now it is replaced by Jesus' death. That is the real and better way to approach God, to relate to God, to meet with God now. Jesus' death has opened up the possibility of forgiveness, relationship with God, wherever we are and whoever we are. And that brings us to our final subpoint. Salvation is open to any who believe. There's a Netflix series called The English Game, about the game of football opening up to the masses in the 19th century. Originally, football was only played by the most privileged schools in England, and the aristocracy thought of it as their game. But despite resistance from the elite, increasingly the door was flung open for everyone else, and these sort of hardened mining towns start taking on the posh toffs, which are some quite amusing encounters. And of course, today, football is enjoyed in every country of the world, no matter what class or background, no matter whether you've got a full-size pitch or if there's just a scrap of ground somewhere. Many of the best players have started off in backyards or council estates or on the streets and slums of the world's poorest nations. Football is now open to anyone, anywhere, and it is much the better for it. Well, similarly, but in a far more significant way, how much better, how wonderful it is that salvation is now flung open wide to anyone, anywhere. Meeting with God is not just for a privileged few. God doesn't hang around in specific buildings anymore. There is nothing holy about going to Jerusalem or to the Vatican or anywhere like that. Sure, it may be interesting, but it won't get us any closer to God than if we were to just simply pray at home or walking along a street. Jesus' death has opened up the privilege of approaching God to anyone, wherever and whoever they are. The point's really made by the centurion who is overseeing Jesus' crucifixion. He wasn't Jewish, he was a Roman, considered enemies of God's people. And presumably to become a centurion, he must have been very good at killing people. So here is a very unlikely person to be accepted by God, we might have thought. And yet it seems that he is the first to be saved after Jesus' death. Salvation is open to anyone, no matter what we might have done. But that doesn't mean that it is actually found by everyone. We've considered how there is real hope for the lost, ignorant crowds, but there seems less hope in Mark's gospel for the religious leaders of Jesus' day. Throughout the whole of Mark's gospel, they had been bent against Jesus, trying just to get rid of him, to stay in charge of their lives themselves. And their cruel mocking of Jesus at his death that we heard read earlier just seems to confirm their rejection of him. Well, Jesus was very clear in his teaching that those who reject him will be rejected by God. Salvation can't be for them because a right response to Jesus is necessary. And so what is it about the centurion's response that is right? We'll have a look at verse 39, our final verse. When the centurion who stood facing Jesus saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." I guess on one hand, we can say that the right response is as simple as believing in Jesus. This guy makes this great declaration of faith. "Truly, this man was the Son of God." But dig a little deeper, and to call Jesus the Son of God is hugely loaded and significant. It is how Mark introduces us to Jesus in the very first verse, the very first sentence of his whole gospel back in chapter 1. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It is a title of utter authority. It basically means that Jesus is God's king, and you have to get on the right side of him. But throughout the gospel, actually no human in Mark's gospel has acknowledged Jesus as the Son until this moment. This is the moment that Mark has been trying to get us as readers to. And we're supposed to think here, bingo, finally. This centurion has had his eyes opened to who Jesus really is. And the really strange thing is that this eureka moment happens as Jesus dies. Is that not strange? Most people looked at the cross and saw weakness and failure. The religious leaders mocked, "Come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." But it's ironically because Jesus doesn't come down that this centurion sees and believes. He looks at the cross and somehow he sees Jesus' divine authority. "Truly, this man is the Son of God." He acknowledges Jesus as God's king, even as he dies, or more accurately, because he was there dying. And that is what Mark wants us as his readers to see too. It's at the cross, as Jesus suffers God's judgment in our place, that he is truly shown to be king, worthy of our following and devotion. Jesus' willingness to lower himself at the cross is what best shows his exalted authority as king. His willingness to embrace weakness is what best shows his strength as king. His laying down of his rights at the cross is what shows his right to be our king. And so as we draw towards a close, I'd love to encourage each of us to just keep reflecting on the cross this Easter. If this some of this is newer to you this morning, I hope that you can see just how we call Good Friday good. I hope you can see a bit more about why it really is good. Jesus' death has opened up the way of salvation to anyone. It is open to you if you're willing to put your trust in Jesus, in his death. If you're willing to make him your king. And for those of us who are already followers of Jesus, I hope that just a bit of time thinking about the cross renews our praise and wonder of Jesus. Particularly perhaps if we're feeling a little bit dry or weary, tired, or just a bit stagnant in our faith perhaps. Maybe just go away, take a bit of time this afternoon, tomorrow, whenever it is, find a quiet spot. Why not read again Mark's account of the cross or another of the Gospels? Why not just have a read, have a think, have a pray? And it will refresh us. The cross is the only source of real living faith. That is where we need to keep coming back to. And the cross is also what motivates us to live with Jesus as King over every area of our lives. If Jesus really is King, if that's what we see at the cross, well then it should help us to give over the reins to Jesus of our life, of our ambitions, of our hopes, our careers, our finances, our relationships, our family, our status. And that may sometimes feel like it is leading us down our own path of suffering. There may be real costs to following Jesus, making him King of every area of our life like that. But as we keep looking to Jesus, his sacrifice for us, we'll be reminded that there's no sacrifice that is too much to give for him in light of all that he has done. Well, why don't I lead us in a prayer to close? Father God, thank you so much that your Son Jesus willingly suffered and died to save sinful people like us. Thank you that if we are following Jesus as our King, we can know that he faced the judgment that we deserved in our place. Thank you so much that salvation is now open to anyone, anywhere. And please would you help us to consider how to live in light of this. Amen.